thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. Here's a stick. Our recent chemostat experiments on these populations revealed some adaptation dynamics. I think that shows the plasticity of the regulatory system to adapt to really novel environments. So I'll spend time trying to explain the data, and as you'll see, it really raises more questions in answering them. So I would really appreciate any feedback, comments. So if there's a small audience, please stop me with every moment that you feel that you have something to be clarified. These are the people involved. Nama Brenner is a theoretical biophysicist from the Department of Chemical Engineering. She's a physicist, in fact. These are the students working on my lab, in my lab, on various parts of this problem. So what I'll do, I'll spend only a few minutes to explain a regulatory network from an evolutionary perspective, and then some more time on the experimental setup that I think will be of some interest to people here, which allows online measurements of the metabolic and regulatory dynamics in continuous culture, and we can later, or after the talk, discuss many technical problems that arise while you try to do this. And then as a warm-up problem, I'll show you that using the chemostat, we can show that there is a clear difference between transient responses and steady state in cell populations. And so this will be a warm-up problem to the real problem of interest for this talk, which is gene recruitment. So what will happen if we rewire the genome and apply selection pressure on the population? And this is a way to study the evolvability potential or the capability of cells to adapt to novel environments. So it will become clear as I'll go on. So from a very simplistic point of view, this is something that you all know. Information is contained in the genome in the form of DNA, but function is carried out by proteins. Function and morphology is carried out by proteins, so the transformation is carried out by a regulatory system that takes inputs from many sources, like the environment, cell cycle, intercellular signals, and especially it's very sensitive to history. Now, what makes evolution a health problem is that mutations occur in this space, but selection occurs in this space. And so in order to really understand evolution, you understand what the regulatory system is doing. And this is how the regulatory system is a dynamical system. And actually, it's a hard dynamical system. It spans a wide range of time scales. And as we go along, you'll see that how difficult it is. So the problem of evolution cannot be solved by just understanding sequences, and cannot be solved by just understanding proteins. You need really to understand regulation, and this is the business that we are interested in. And one thing to note here is that regulatory systems bring in intermediate timescales that are not always appreciated. You see, when a mutation occurs, until selection fixes this mutation in a population, there must be some intermediate timescale that cell physiology needs to support this mutation. And these intermediate timescales between, say, one generation and 100 generations in yeast cells, this is the intermediate timescale that we are going to focus on. Very surprisingly, in the biological literature, this timescale is completely neglected. Okay, so people either look on mutations and selection after hundreds of generations, or look on a very short transient responses of cells, but they don't worry about the intermediate time scales that take you from here to here all the way until a mutation is fixated in the population. And one of the reasons is that experimentally it's a much harder thing to do, to measure. So we have two hard things. One is we have to deal with a dynamical system. Second, we have to stretch time for long durations. Now, it turned out, and this is a well-known result, there is a lot of universality in regulation. So this is an example. These are families of transcription factors in humans down to east. And one of the problems I'm interested in is that a regulatory system spans a huge combinatorial space. It's really huge. I mean, even if many of these states are impossible for some reasons, there are still so many others that are possible. Nevertheless, the number of stable cell types, for example, observed during embryogenesis, is usually very small. For humans, for example, we have something like 250 cell types. It means that the number of constraints on the system had to be at the same level or same number of degrees of freedom. And it also means that the potential of genomes is far greater than what realized in evolution. And what I'm interested in is really removing this constraints and some of these constraints and see how phase space is open. Okay? So for example, if we move a constraint, can we increase this number by much? What determines this number? Why it's so small? Are there any special features of the regulatory system that constrain it to be I don't want to talk about it. I want to go on what.
Because if you look at the integrated plane, you also have lots of feedback systems. And if you are.
Right. Right. In engineering, this is solved by carefully designing every feedback loop. Otherwise, the plane is crashes, right? I'll show you momentarily that cells are not like that. Okay, so this is exactly the point. If you have high degree of plasticity, it means that nothing is really well designed for any special function, and evolution plays with this. Nevertheless, there is a clear scaling of the number of cell types with complexity of organisms. So fly don't have the same number of cell types as we do, and this number is ridiculously small, really. No, I don't know, but it's a power law, as usual, right? Sorry?
You said it's the number of cell types increases with the complexity of the organism. That's not a definition.
Right, because the number of genes does not determine the complexity. You know, rice has more genes than we do, and onion also. So what?
Is an organism more complex when it has more cell types? It's
just a vague notion, just to tell you. Actually, there are measurements. For example, between fly and human, you can say that humans are more complex. We can talk, okay? They don't.
Okay.
But there's no clear definition, but let's leave it vague. But clearly, the number of cell types is something that really bothers me, because the number of possibilities is so great. So yeah, you need to design very carefully everything to keep the constraint at this level. But you know, when you try to do this on physical system, you usually fail. Okay, unless you really design it for a single function, everything, you know.
But there are many examples of organisms that have response of
that. Right. So the numbers can fluctuate, but you don't have organisms with zillions of cell types. The human is more or less the upper limit, so. So the number is ridiculously small compared to but on the other side, yeah. So, but the potential of the genome of this unicellular organism is far greater than this single cell type. Now, this is a short summary of main features that you have to keep in mind. So, these are not the only features, but these are the main features that I care about now. First, there is a huge combinatorial space that's spanned by the regulatory system. Second, there is network dynamics in the background. So these are highly interacting dynamical systems that again span a wide range of time scales. And this is an interesting feature. And the third thing that I'll emphasize during this talk is that there are important population effects that are mostly neglected by biologists. It means that history and epigenetic inheritance play an important role. So we are dealing with cell populations, and you cannot take a cell and think of it as an independent realization of something, because it has history, it came from an ancestor, and proteins propagate in this population, and epigenetic phenomena propagate. So already a long time ago, this is the famous paper from the 70s by King and Wilson, that worried about differences between human and chimpanzees. In 1975, they came to the conclusion that the regulatory mutation account for the major biological differences between human and chimpanzee, and this is a general conclusion. Between species, what makes a difference is not the building blocks, not the genes themselves, but actually the way they regulated. And with time, this became really a strong conclusion now in the form of textbooks. So I put here some references for you that discuss this point. And you have to appreciate that regulatory evolution creates new combination of gene expression, and by that enabling the increase in the information content of genomes without really changing the gene number. Okay? Now, gene recruitment is one of these processes in the literature, sometimes there are other names for it. It's one of these processes that allows the evolution of regulatory systems. So if you have a gene X under promoter A, it's controlled by transcription factor A, then if something happened and a new promoter is located upfront of this gene, say B, then the transcription factor B will start to operate this gene. So for example, in development, it means that new genes will be expressed in cells at locations and times that were not been expressed before. And gene recruitment is one of the major driving forces in evolution of regulatory systems. And in that respect, also of speciation of new species. It can occur by different mechanisms, by mutations in sequences and promoters, or by insertions of sequences. And usually people think that insertion of sequences by recombination, say, or transposon or whatever, is a larger effect than point mutation in promoters. Okay?
The underlying rate is different, or it's just the size of the regulatory?
No, it's a here is an example, just an arbitrary example, there are many of them. These are different muscle. This is a gene of responsible for satiated muscles in different organisms. And you see that the different transcription factors appear in different combinations, even though it's for different species. This is chicken, this is rat, this is mouse. You never see in this example the full list of transcription factors, but you see different combinations of them. And in that respect, people believe that this cannot occur by point mutation in promoter. This had to occur through insertions of sequences. And by doing that, you express this gene at different points in time and location, and you change the course of development. Okay?
Sorry, I still don't understand the previous statement that you made.
So what I'm saying is that in order to bring a new transcription factor here, and then another one, people believe that changing promoters by mutation is not enough, because this is usually a much weaker effect. You need too many mutations to occur simultaneously at the same region. But that's the the quantitative thing says that most of the promoter, if you change a single base pair, for example, the binding will not change very much. So there is an estimate.
Just by comparing these different.
I don't think that there is enough data to say something conclusively, but people, the estimates show that this is more or less impossible to get by point mutations.
Basically, you're splicing in.
Right, right. A sequence that will bring in a new promoter thing. Okay, or a sequence of promoters. Oh yeah, yeah. So this, for example, comes from such studies. Yeah. So it becomes systematic. So people realize that this is a very important driving force. Once you realize that, there's a lot of work going on.
The main problem is that you have to identify in the promoter sequence which proteins that can bind there.
Yeah, but there is a technology now that allows to do this on large scale.
For example, looking at homologous promoters in different fly species, so that you look close enough. And one would be able to recognize.
Yeah, the rate of evolution of these promoters, and then by doing that, you can appreciate. But this work is just, I think, is not conclusive yet.
No one has actually.
Not that I know of. Maybe there is. But the references I gave you are pretty recent, and they claim that it's a soft idea, but. It will become, I think, very quantitative in the very near future. There is a technology to identify protein binding to specific locations on the DNA that you can now apply on large scale.
Because what you are saying is that the evolution of promoters is much different than the evolution of proteins.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
So
for example, human and chimpanzee, the genes are very, very, very little difference between them. But the promoter has. A recent example. No. Human and chimpanzee is not long. In 75 it was an hypothesis. These days it's not an hypothesis. We have a sequence of the human genome and chimpanzee genome now.
They are very similar.
But people identify specific locations where evolution occurred.
And it is in the common region which are.
It's much more complicated than this. The order is important. For example, the order of promoters might be important. The distance between them is important. So
the region, not the coding region, is more variable than the coding region.
The coding region is much less variable because there is a lot of restrictions on the functionality of enzymes. But if you change regulation, then you can do much more with the same building blocks. So this is the concept,
the data should actually be there already with different fly species.
Yeah, but it's for people like you that to take it and then quantify it. So it's not. Maybe it was done right now, but it's not. There's a lot to do, and because it's about regulation, it's much more problematic than just comparing sequences of. Homologous proteins. So it's a very good problem, I think. But
so all these multiple transcription factors that, you know, in the previous example, let's take that concrete example. How are they interacting? Is it mostly additive, or are they?
No. It could be additive, but it could be much more. It could be nonlinear effects.
There's a catalog.
There is no general notion. I mean, in eukaryotes, it's a zoo. I mean, you can get.
It's typically additive plus fresh.
No.
It's not.
No way. Okay, so our program is really focused on this big question: is what type of evolutionary forces shape genetic regulatory networks, and how? So the experiments we try to mimic a natural evolutionary event of gene recruitment. So we place a promoter upstream of an essential gene that is deleted from its original regulatory system. This is an event of gene recruitment that could occur in evolution. So we make a linkage between an essential gene and the foreign regulatory system. We rewire the genome, and then we measure the capacity of cells to adapt in different environments. So this is the program. Let's rewire the genome and see the capacity of cells to start to appreciate the potential of genomes. And then we can ask all kinds of questions. For example, does cellular physiology support arbitrary gene recruitment events? And surprisingly enough, even poor yeast cells can really support arbitrary gene recruitment. What is the evolvability potential of cell populations? Can you quantify this? It requires to open the time and population dimension, so this makes the experiment harder. You need to work over long time scales in stable conditions and large populations. So this is research in progress, but already there are many results that are fascinating. So I don't know if you need this, but let me spend 2 minutes explaining the chemostat, because all the results that I'm going to show you will depend that we have common language around the chemostat. So the chemostat is an ancient technique invented by Novick and Ziller. You have nutrients flowing in at a constant rate, and you have cells and medium coming out at the same rate, so this volume is fixed. You have your cells growing here, mixing, and you keep the temperature fixed. And at steady state, the growth rate equals dilution rate. Okay, we work with large population, something like 10 cells. So the reason there is a steady state is realized by looking on these growth curves that was invented by Monod. So you have this limit. You have one of the nutrients in the medium becomes limiting. So this is SU, and this axis is the amount of limiting nutrient in the chemostat, and this axis is the growth rate, and these are the equation for the biomass, and the equation for S, and for a given yield, for a given metabolic state of cells, you'll have a given Monod curve, and this is the dilution rate of the chemostat. So what happens is that if cells all of a sudden dilute, so the population become less dense than can be supported by the steady state point, so you find the system finds itself here, then there is more limiting nutrient per cell, which will drive growth rate down to this rate. I said it the opposite, sorry. If you're here, it will be driven over here because there are less cells, and cells can grow faster because there is more limiting nutrient per cell. If you're on the other side, it means that cell density is too high, and it will drive the dynamics toward this steady state. Now, what is important for what I'm going to show you later is that if I change conditions or if cells adapt, so metabolism is changed, then the population switches to another Monod curve. So, for example, in galactose, metabolism is poorer than in glucose for yeast, and so this would be the curve for galactose, and this would be the curve for glucose. And then what will happen if you switch medium from galactose to glucose, you switch from the red curve to the blue curve, so you keep growing cells at steady state at the same rate, because at steady state dilution rate equals the growth rate, but then you can support higher density of cells, because you need less limiting nutrient per cell to support the same growth rate.
Okay. You use a cow as a chemostat.
Okay. Yeah, but it's, you know, it smells bad, and et cetera, so we don't do it. What is really important is from transition from here to here, there will be some dynamics, but this allows us, by following the density of cells in the chemostat, continuously over time, it allows us to really see the metabolic changes. And so the yield changes, and this will bring it to different curves. Okay, so this.
What if the growth rates of the cells changes as a consequence of the...
No, so what do you mean? So the underlying change in growth rate is the metabolic change. So you switch to another Monod curve, and the system will find a new steady state, which will always be fixed around equals growth rate, that equals the dilution rate at steady state. It might be that the system will never find a steady state because it will go into some crazy oscillation or whatever, but under normal working conditions, there is always a stable steady state here, which determines the growth rate. It's just that the number of cells that can be supported under the same medium in the chemostat is now be bigger if the metabolism is better.
So I imagine that the cell cycle period is something that...
No, there is a lot of variability in the population, but the average population biomass rate, this is a mean field description, right? So it's the average rate of biomass growth is determined by this equation. There's nothing more than that. You could add fluctuation, describe it from the microscopic point of view, but there's no need.
Okay. Yeah, this is something really basic. But there is some dilution there, but if it's too large...
Yeah, of course. Of course. Of course. If you put this dilution... if you see there is a maximum here. So this is an unlimited population. In batch culture, you usually work in such a way that you are at the maximum condition unless you start to starve cells. Before saturation occurs, you are here. If you put your dilution rate here, and this is a good description of the population, then you wash out the population. And you'll see in the density an exponential decay of the population at the rate T. So this is to carry out the program, we've built this is the first generation. We have now a second generation that is better, but this is a homemade chemostat. This is the chemostat itself. It's around 100 milliliter. It's tiered. It has a double wall with water running, so the whole culture is wrapped by water at the right temperature. For this, it's 30 degrees. We flow nutrients in. From here, we dilute by two pipes out to keep the volume fixed, and then the output. So this is it constructed in such a way, in a modular way. So this is the chemostat. The last thing you want to happen is something happens to the chemostat, because if you run the population for a month or so, so this is protected against many disasters that can happen. Then in a modular way, there is an online measurement system. That part of it you see here, this is an electronic valve that switches the output of the chemostat through sessions that take water at high pressure, wash the measurement cells, take a reference to see that nothing changed there, and then switch to the output of the chemostat. The chemostat needs to flow all the time. You never stop it. But it's just switching. This takes care through the computer of the switching thing. It flows it through these cells here. I don't know if you see. There is a cell here that uses this spectrophotometer to make all the measurements. So it's a light scattering in a flow channel that measures the cell density. And then it goes into this box that measures fluorescence level from a GFP reporter that we put under. And then another very important feature is this box that you see here. So another output from the chemostat goes into this cell collector that we've built that collects samples of cell at accurate time points in long experiment for undefined time and freezes it instantaneously. So I can explain later how it works. Now, second generation actually monitors the dynamics and takes samples at a rate that accommodates. If there is fast dynamic, you want better resolution. By doing this, we have all the full history of the chemostat in the freezer. So we can go back and ask questions about cells along the dynamic. But we can talk about it later if you're interested in details. There are many details. There are many things need to be solved. It's measurements in flow. There are a lot of bubbles. The medium is fluorescence. You need to take care of many, many details. We can talk about it later. Okay, so now let's go to the experiments. I need to explain for people. What?
What medium? Oh, no, sorry.
It is. So let me explain first, because most of the people are used to bacteria. I need to spend explaining you what is the GAL system, which is the basic model system. It's like operon in bacteria, but different. Okay, so this is the GAL system is the best characterized genetic switch ever in eukaryotes. It works as a switch in pure galactose. It's on through a positive feedback, and in pure glucose it's off. And its only known role, only known function, is to utilize galactose. And this is done by a series of structural genes that you see here. This is the permease, GAL2, that allows galactose in. And this is the positive feedback. The expression of galactose goes up. it allows more galactose to get in. These are structural genes to take care of different enzymatic operations, and until it brings the system to glucose 6P, which is the normal glycosis metabolism. It is operated by a single transcription factor, GAL4, which is inhibited by another gene, GAL80, and the inhibition is removed by a third guy, GAL3, upon the induction by galactose, and it needs also ATP. Okay, so this is the textbook picture of the GAL system. Again, the only known function is galactose utilization. These guys, the regulatory genes, are also regulated by the same complex, so they keep regulating themselves, and the same promoter appear in all of these, outside of minor modifications. Maybe you can discuss later. So this is the complex. If this complex is active, then there is a transcription of all these genes. Okay? Yeah, GAL3, no, it's not known actually. There are a lot of debates.
The cartoon
is just a sloppy PowerPoint cartoon that doesn't mean any biological significance. In fact, there is a lot of debate where it occurs, and there are some recent results that show that it's between the cytoplasm and the nucleus, the transport that is... The functional point of view, this is the picture. You need GAL3 to inhibit GAL80 from inhibiting the transcription. So this is the operation. So this is an old picture, but there is a debate because of more recent results that show that this might not be. This complex, GAL4, GAL80, GAL3, the way it's presented here, not necessarily a functional complex, but operational function, operates also GAL3 and GAL80. GAL4 is not regulated by the system.
No, but GAL4 upregulates.
GAL4 by itself, because this is in excess in most situations, it's inhibited from doing anything. But if this comes into rescue, then the system starts to upregulate this guy, and all these guys.
There is a positive feedback.
Sorry?
Presumably not directly from GAL4, but from galactose inside the cell.
So the textbook idea is that this guy needs galactose and ATP in order to be active. No, this is, again, it's a PowerPoint. What do you mean? No, this is just to distinguish between the structural genes that have enzymatic role in galactose utilization and the regulatory part. So these guys have only regulatory function, but these have structural function. So here is a warm-up problem. What will happen to a yeast population if we grow them in a chemostat under galactose conditions? So the chemostat is not limited by galactose. In this example, is limited by amino acid. There is plenty of galactose, and then we switch medium to pure glucose, and again there is plenty of glucose. So after a few generations, a few dilution times, there is only glucose in the system. So what you see here is what we do, we measure also distributions in the population. So this is the histogram of fluorescence level from a GFP under GAL system. Okay, very simple. In galactose, we can talk later, there is very interesting characteristic, always an exponential tail. The system is highly variable. Standard deviation over mean is of order 1 and larger. This is the characteristic. And then we switch to glucose. There is a fast decay of the distribution because of glucose repression. So the switch is off because of the introduction of glucose. At this point, a standard biological experiment is over. But since we have a chemostat, we keep running it, and then we encounter an interesting phenomena. This is not a stable point. Distribution starts to open. Again, it's pure glucose There's nothing else that can do it. There's no galactose around. And in fact, we can measure the kinetics. Distribution start to come up. And what is really interesting...
What's your label here? Arbitrary units? So
we just normalize it. This is the...
Are you expressing like GFP or something?
Yeah, I said we express GFP under GAL regulation, under the standard GAL promoter. And this is the distribution from a collection of cells from the population in the chemostat of this fluorescence level.
You just
put
GFP.
By GFP.
Question. So what is the absolute efficacy of the cell in metabolizing glucose versus glycose? Does it do a better job? Does it
expand? Yeah. I'll come to it. You don't see the chemostat cell densities in these graphs. I'll come to it later. But if you switch from galactose to glucose, cell density in the chemostat goes up because you go to better metabolism, so you can support the same growth rate with less limiting nutrient. Okay? In hours, but it doesn't matter. This is again a warm-up problem, and time is also warming up. So let me go quickly because this is not the most interesting thing. But it's interesting enough because what you see here, that if you work out patiently the chemostat, you find out a very, very surprising result, is that the transient response of the strong switch that's supposed to be on galactose and off in glucose, it's neither stable in the on condition, neither stable in the off condition, but there is some intermediate level which is exactly identical in pure galactose and pure glucose. Okay? And the transition time is around between 5 to 10 generations. So it's small. It's 5 generations, the typical time scale.
So once you're in that situation, what happens if you change the... From galactose to glucose?
Let's do it later. It's not important. You have to appreciate what you see here. The textbook will tell you that in pure glucose, the switch is off. And galactose doesn't have any function in glucose that is known of. Then what you discover, and this is even more surprising, is that the on condition, galactose is also a metastable state. You need to wait a little bit to see that it can decay to a different state and stabilize there for a long time.
And the chemostat is already...
Chemostat is under normal...
Zero.
Yeah. The chemostat is stabilized much before.
The cell also doesn't change.
No, the chemostat is stabilized much before that.
What is the eating before the galactose? It turns on?
No, we either always start from galactose.
Equilibrate
the chemostat in galactose. We did a lot of experiments also to turn on from raffinose to galactose. Raffinose is a neutral medium in that respect. It doesn't repress the system, doesn't induct it, but induce it. It's between 5 and 10, more closer to 5.
So that time constant to come to equilibrium, is that limited by sort of the time scale for genetic change, or is that actually the protein?
No, okay, we can argue for days about this. There is no underlying genetic change to my mind, but let me show you a much more surprising result, that, then we can argue if it's genetic or not. But nevertheless, if it's genetic, it's within 5 generations, everything is fixed. Mm-hmm. So this is an astronomical time scale. Because
question. Is it genetic or is it a protein?
Right, so it's an open question. Let's leave it open at the moment.
Does the dashed line represent the transient response?
Yeah, when you start the chemostat in galactose, you encounter this thing. Or if you switch from raffinose to galactose, the system will start low and then it will go to high induction. But you see, the point is that to see this, you need to run the chemostat under stable condition for long enough. And most batch cultures that will just switch medium and look after a few hours will miss this, because they will see some transient response and interpret it as a switch condition. But you need to be careful about what is steady state and what is transient. So the rest of the talk I want to spend about gene recruitment, but keep this problem in the back of your mind, because you see much more surprising results, that the only interpretation of them is that you need to believe in this to occur. Okay, so what we do, we ask ourselves, what would happen? So this is just GFP. You could say, okay, it's just fluorescence. Who cares? I don't know what the GAL system is doing with glucose. Who cares about this? Let's put it under functional test, meaning let's recruit an arbitrary essential gene to the GAL system and switch from galactose to glucose. Now the system needs to do something in order to survive, because the essential gene, if you switch to glucose, will be repressed. So we take E3, it's an essential gene in the histidine biosynthesis pathway. We deleted it from the genome entirely. I mean, the decoding region plus the upstream regulatory region, there's no remnant of its regulation or its coding region in the genome, and put it under the GAL system together with GFP under a promoter that goes in both directions. So we have monitored both GFP and E3. And then we put it in a chemostat, and here is a list of challenges that the cells need to meet in order to survive.
What did that gene do again?
It's part of the production of histidine, amino acid histidine. So it's a bottleneck. It's an essential gene in the pathway of histidine. And if the medium lacks histidine, which is the case we are interested in, then if cells cannot express this at highly tuned level, they just die.
And it's only used during the reproduction, right? Because the histidine is putting histones, or?
No, histidine, it's amino acid.
You
need to produce it all the time if there is no histidine in the medium. So in pure galactose, the GAL system must simultaneously take care of two metabolic tasks now. This multitasking, I'll come to it at the end. It's really a big challenge because there might be contradicting requirements from the system. It needs to support both galactose utilization and histidine biosynthesis. In pure glucose, E3 is repressed. So it lacks expression, and the system is under problem. The dynamic range of the GAL system is huge. It's around 1,000-fold. So between high induction and repression, the GAL genes, and I'll show you measurements in a moment, can change by a factor of 1,000. The amino acid biosynthesis, if you open any biochemistry book, you'll see that it's highly tuned, and the expression level can change by only a few fold. And the reason amino acids are highly tuned is because amino acid can serve as an intermediate to another amino acid, and you don't want to create a lot of intermediates along the way that are dead bodies and will create a lot of problems. So the system is highly regulated by feedback inhibition and all kinds of things. And the normal for HIS-3, but it's normal for any amino acid, is just a few fold change in regulation. It's, if you take the GAL system at the highly induced state and the highly repressed, in fluorescence you cannot get this because there is autofluorescence. You cannot get the full range. I'll show you a messenger RNA measurements in a second that will show you the full range. The fluorescence is problem. Yeah, fluorescence is just you cannot see this factor because you have a floor of autofluorescence.
So therefore, that distribution that you showed in glucose state is noise.
No. It's not noise. It's a repressed state, but you cannot. The difference between highly induction and highly repressed in fluorescence will never be 1,000. It's much smaller because you have a floor. And the last thing is that the recruited E3 is detached from its natural feedback. So if something happens along the pathway or in other amino acid or in all of a sudden you introduce histidine to the medium, how E3 will know about it? It's now connected to a different system. It doesn't have its normal regulation. And this is the basic experiment before we go to chemostat. So you take these cells that we made the linkage between E3 and the GAL system, and you put them on plates. This is galactose plate and this is glucose plate lacking histidine. So E3 is an essential enzyme. In galactose plates, you see very nice uniform size colonies. You see the distribution here of the size that appear after 2 days. After 4 days, it's completely mature. You see all the colonies. In glucose plates, after 4 days, you see nothing. And remember, glucose metabolism is faster than galactose metabolism. It's better. You see nothing. The tendency is, of course, to throw the plates, go and do something else. But we keep it in the incubator, and all of a sudden, after 6 days, the first colonies appear, and after 14 days, this is the situation. So what happens here is that you get an exponential distribution of sizes of the colonies. Okay? You see the distribution here. And as you wait longer and longer, more colonies will appear here. And if you wait long enough, all the colonies that appear on this plate actually show up on the glucose plate. But the distribution is exponential in time, which means that there is underlying some process, something like that, some random process that switching on these cells to grow a colony.
What was the organism again?
Yeast. Not cow. Yeast.
Just regular, like
brewer yeast. Yeah, budding yeast. So to appreciate the dynamics, we have to go to a chemostat. So this is the chemostat experiment. What you see is a running time. So this is one of the experiments that can tell you what's going on. We first grow the system in pure galactose. Again, medium leaking histidine, so this is essential. There is a steady state that's stabilized here. And then at the arrow here, we switch medium from pure galactose to pure glucose.
What is, just for normalization, what's the wild type comparison for the steady state?
It's not important.
Yeah, but just for my curiosity.
In galactose, they're doing fine.
Does they look comparable to wild type?
Right, but if time permits, which I'm afraid maybe not, I can show you that there is a lot of adaptation that can go. That these cells can undergo metabolic changes that will do much, much, much better. So this question is not well defined because it depends on the history of the population. But if you just take a population from the freezer, you start it, you initiate the chemostat with it, you stabilize a steady state. And then you switch to glucose, you encounter different phases. First, cell population shoots up. And this is very easy to understand. The cells have enough resources here, either histidine or E3 messenger RNA, to switch smoothly into glucose metabolism. And as I told you, it just means that it switched to a different monocle that allows it to shoot up the density. So what we measure here is the OD, but it's proportional to the density of cells. And then at some point, a crisis occurs due to burning of resources. So cells, and I'll show you the measurements of the resources in a moment. So cells finish up all the stocks of histidine, E3, messenger RNA, etc., and the system starts to decline. Not in a smooth way, there are peaks occurring here. And then what happens is that there is some point that the population could adapt, reverses direction, and goes into a nice glucose steady state. This nice glucose steady state can last forever. I mean, literally forever, hundreds of generations. But then we do a second cycle. This is time in generations, by the way. So all these dynamics occur over something like 10 generations. We make a second switch here from glucose back to galactose. It goes down. And then we switch back to glucose and see the cell population memorize its previous state. And I'll show you a little measurement in a second. All the messenger RNA levels and the metabolic level shoots directly into the glucose, as if the system learned here the trick, learned a new pathway, a new thing, and it memorized it here. It can go directly to the new state and memorize it forever here again.
So what happens between 2 and 3? So this is just some
here?
Stochastic dynamics?
It's not stochastic. No. There is a dynamic. I'll show you in a moment more details. What happens here is that cells start to adapt even here, and then this is the time it takes for the population to recover from switching to turn on the GAL system in glucose and operate E3, tune E3 to the right level that will bring it to very nice glucose metabolism. It's good that you asked, because this is next slide. So we run the experiment a few times. And you see immediately what are the robust features. You see that the exponential decay is a robust feature of the dynamics. This line, I don't know if you see it, is the chemostat dilution rate. So if cells would stop growing, then the exponent would be like that. And you see what happens here is that there is a lot of cell growth here. Even at this early point, there is enough cell growth to allow the population not to decay in the chemostat dilution rate. And then different populations overcome the challenge at with some stochasticity in time, which is not big. This is just 20 hours, which is around 3 to 4 generations. Okay?
So have you tried isolating any of these new yeast and see what...
You'll see in a moment, we'll do this. But and again, once adaptation occurs, you see that this is semi-logarithmic, right? So you see that the exponent of increase is identical. So this is a robust feature, and the steady state is identical. So this is a remarkable result. If you run chemostat a few times and you get this identical, this identical, and this identical, it's really a robust feature. And this, I'll argue later, will be very much against spontaneous mutations. This is not what you normally expected from...
Why is the steady state so similar? If you told me that even within a wild-type population, the steady states can have lots of change depending on history and so on.
It's the same history.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same issue.
Exactly. So you start with exactly the same, just divide one population of you.
Oh yeah. We start from the same clone. So
clonal color.
Yeah.
But the time scale is different from that Gal recovery that you showed in the beginning.
It 6 hours. Yeah, but here is a much bigger challenge. You'll see in a moment how big is the challenge. The system needs not only to turn on Gal system, it needs to tune EC3. This is a much more problematic.
Yeah,
there is no histidine whatsoever in all the experiments I'm going to show you. There is GFP. I'll show you in a second. There is GFP, not in this graph, but there is GFP under the same promoter as.
I thought the construction of this was in your warm up exercise, you showed that Gal opera, which is supposed to be off, actually turns itself on.
Right. But this without selection, without pressure, because it's not functional for anything that we know of.
But now you're selecting it, right?
Right.
And so I would
thought... Yeah, but there is a lot... But the cells need to do much more here than just turn on Gal system. We'll see in a moment.
Well, they're not just turning on,
the challenge is much bigger. I put the challenges on. I mean, for example, E3, if it's overexpressed, it's very bad for the cells. So it's not just opening the Gal system, it's on time scales, it needs to do something. And the something is fantastic. It shows really the system develops new feedbacks. So the Gal system, as I'll show momentarily, will read what happens on the amino acid biosynthesis now, and they'll accommodate to this. How the cells know to do this will show David that it's not a plane. Right, it's not an engineering system. It's really completely plastic. This is the GFP measurement. We'll come to it, to the messenger RNA, which show more detail in a moment. But I just want to point out, this is the fluorescence level per cell. You see that during this decay, there are bursts in the Gal system. It turned out to be that this is the if it's just moving from galactose to glucose, this is what happens. The Gal system tries to open. But now the system needs to do something more, and the most severe thing it needs to do is that E3 is overexpressed here without control, which is very bad for the cells.
And this is also reproducible.
Yeah.
What is this vector for what's in the
board? GFP under the same promoter as E3.
It makes sense after you switch to glucose that Gal is down regulated, right? Because it's no longer needed. But then it realizes that it needs to have some new screen and it starts crossing.
Yeah. This burst here. But it needs to do much more than this.
So GFP responds differently than
is that the growth rate?
Than E3.
No, you don't know what E3 is doing. I'll show you E3 in a second. I'll show you the messenger RNA levels of E3 along the dynamics in a moment. Here you don't see E3. You see the cell metabolism on this curve, and you see GFP.
And are you sure that the promoter of E3 has not been changed?
Yeah, we will sequence it along the experiment. There's no change in the promoter. But you'll see it's a much more global phenomenon. It's not... They're not. Actually, there is a very little cell death here. As I showed you, there is a lot of cell growth already at this stage. If it would be cell death or stop growth of growth, this decay would be at the dilution rate of the chemostat.
But it does start with the dilution rate of the chemostat.
It's
No, no. No, it's this is, I mean, there is already a very early stage here. A lot, and also, if you look on the Microsoft, there is a lot of budding. I mean, cells are growing. It's a, they can overcome this. So these are the messenger RNA levels of the different GAL genes together with GFP and HIS-3. And already here you see something interesting. So first of all, of course, on your lamp here, you don't see, in the background there was the OD dynamics that you cannot see here. You can see it on the screen. But you could imagine it's the same graph as before. You see that already at the onset of switching to glucose, there is a huge, this is logarithmic scale, there is a huge drop in the messenger RNA level of all GAL genes. So this is the 1,000-fold change in messenger RNA. Then adaptation start, and this is the second switch. See how remarkable the messenger RNA level goes directly to the level that it was learned in the first cycle. You see it goes boom, boom, and also here. Now what is very interesting, these are the regulatory genes, GAL3, GAL80, is doing very different dynamics, kinetics, than the structural GAL genes. And what is most interesting, and I'll come to it in a second, is that the ratio between GFP and HIS-3 can be tuned. Okay, so the system brings HIS-3 to the right level. And this you cannot read from here, I'll show you in a moment. The system really tunes this level compared to the GFP in order to tune HIS-3 to the right level. Okay, so we have to go into more details. There is a slight difference between the different promoters of the GAL genes. So GFP is under the promoter of this blue guy here, GAL10, and HIS-3 is under the GAL1 promoter, the red one. Okay, there is a slight difference. You see there is a difference in expression between the two. Because the natural system works with a divergent promoter. The same sequence operates the transcription factor in both directions. So we did exactly copy of this. What is really interesting, you see that the blue guy is lower in expression than the red guy. Here is the opposite. Already here.
Well, it could be that the regulation is activating instead of repressing.
What do you mean? No, it's not bacteria. It's all activating. There's no repression here. There is no repressor here. There is a single activator, GAL4. There's nothing more than this. There's no repressor in the system. There are no repressors.
No, but I don't know. Why isn't the level of GFP and HIS-3 the same if they are both on the same promoter?
But that's what I'm telling you. Because it's, and I'll show you in a moment a situation that it will become the same. Because the system needs to down-regulate HIS-3. Yeah. Because if HIS-3 would be on this level, it would be overexpressing.
Yes, I understand that you say the promoter for both HIS-3 and GFP is exactly the same.
Is approximately the same. Well, you see, I have to talk in different levels. If you don't know HIS at all, for you it's the same. But for HIS people, GAL1 promoter, so this is pGAL1, and this is pGAL10. If you go to the genome, you find this sequence. And there is a slight asymmetry on the operation to the right and to the left. We put HIS-3 here and GFP here. Now, what you find on this
I thought initially I would expect to put GFP exactly what you did with HIS-3. So to copy the promoter instead of acting on the HIS-3, to act also on GFP in some other place on the genome. Left and right, of course, would not be the same.
But it's more remarkable. Not only it's not the same, it's the opposite of what you expect. Because here, GAL1 is larger than GAL10 expression. So the red guy is larger in expression than the blue guy.
Wait
a second. HIS-3 is less than GFP. So the same promoter, and the sequence, there is nothing else that entered there. The GAL system with a single transcription factor, by some miracle, could introduce a feedback loop that allows to tune this compared to this, irrespective of what the natural system is doing.
But in any case, we're looking at messenger RNA abundance, which also depends on the rate of degradation.
Yeah. This is a balance between transcription. I'm not saying that it's transcription and related.
But I don't understand. Why is there such an unknown? In principle, I can imagine the DSP and message and history message have different degradation rates. So I don't know what they are.
But you'll see in a moment. Either it's
full degradation or transcription or both.
The system can precisely tune this level compared to this. I'll show you in a moment. We didn't come to it yet.
So that final happy state seems to be different from the initial happy state.
Oh yeah, because you see there is. You remember the burst in GFP?
Yeah.
This is the burst here. Well, and what happens is that the system.
I'm not looking at that. The burst in GFP has nothing to do with the switch. What you showed before of a burst of GFP, there is red light and fluorescent. That has nothing to do with the question.
Of course it has. It's under the same transcription factor. What do you mean?
You said that for GFP it acts to the left and for the switch.
It's the same transcription factor operating with the same promoter with a slight modification that will give you some right-left asymmetry. Don't worry about it. You worry about the wrong thing. What? First, they look similar. There's something going on collectively here, but look on the difference. It's the opposite of what you expect. And not only the opposite, this is controlled by the system. I'll show you in a second that this can be tuned at large levels to the right working point.
Let
me go on because many of the questions you become clear. So the reason we chose E3 is a very nice chemical, 3 amino 3-azole, that works as a competitive inhibitor to the enzyme. So if you introduce it at a given concentration, then it blocks the enzymatic activity, and then to do the same metabolism, you really need to increase the level of expression. So this is a very nice way of introducing more pressure on the population. So this is a comparison between two experiments. The one that I've shown you before with no CET, no competitive inhibitor, and one with very high level of competitive inhibitor. So normal cells, wild-type cells, die at 10 millimolar of this competitive inhibitor. And the reason is that I told you that the level of the dynamic range of expression that HIS-3 can undergo is only a few fold. So if you put a lot of this, you just kill the cell. Now here, the GAL system can open a wide dynamic range, so it can work with much higher level. I'll show you later that it can go very far. But this is a comparison. Again, you see the same phases. You see a much deeper decay, and you see much longer adaptation time before it shoots off to exactly the same steady state. Okay, so the same. This is the first cycle you've seen before. So, in fact, working with different concentration, the adaptation time goes linearly with the concentration of CET. So the more competitive inhibitor you put, the longer the adaptation time.
Is there a specific transcription factor that creates
CET? No, CET is just a small molecule that works as an analog substrate and blocks his enzymatic activity. And the reason we chose this is that East people use this very commonly, and there's a lot of study on CET. There are no side effects, so people use it very often in East biology. So this is the remarkable result that I wanted to show. You see, this is a comparison of the messenger RNA levels of the different GAL genes and GFP and E3 for the two experiments. This is without competitive inhibitor. This is with the competitive inhibitor. So this is the comparison of the experiment you've seen before. Now you see in the background the OD of the system. So see what happens. And you see already here that if we increase the pressure on the histidine pathway by introducing this, all the GAL genes, this is the same scale, all the GAL genes in glucose increases the level of messenger RNA compared to this. This is what you see here. And even more remarkable, E3 to GFP ratio is tuned by the system according to the concentration of this guy. It means directly that the GAL system could read the problem on the histidine pathway, develop a new feedback that allows it to change, at least here all the GAL genes, but I'll show you in a moment that there are hundreds of genes that are changed, and tune precisely the level of E3 independent of the rest of the system, in fact. So there is a question of differentiation here. There is a single transcription factor. Nothing happened to the promoters because we sequenced them along the experiment here and here. And nevertheless, the system could change the ratio between these two guys compared to the ratio between these two guys. Okay? So it's really a remarkable plasticity. It's not only that the GAL system could open in glucose. This is already trivial after you saw the worm experiment, but the system could develop new feedbacks that allows it to read new inputs to a regulatory system that never encountered this before. Okay?
What was this ADH?
This is just a control. So this is, we took a few genes just to see that this is not a metabolic change. This is really a regulatory change because this is just a control. Okay. So if you work out, because we have collection of cells along the dynamics, we can run array, DNA array experiments. So I'll not bother you with all the details. But there are hundreds of genes that are following or leading these dynamics. And there is enrichment for part of it that it's metabolic and part of it that is regulatory. I don't want to discuss it because I don't know what this time situation is. I don't have a clue. I don't know if this is right. And it depends on you. Okay, so let me go to a more something that will be of more interest along this line is the maintenance of the adapted state. Yeah.
Before you, I mean, it sounds like you're searching a little bit, but just before you do that, so one question and one comment. So The one question is that, so just your sort of understanding of this is that it's some kind of a functional adaptation and sort of the state of the promoter region or something like that, without actually there being a genetic change?
No. I didn't say that. I'm very careful. I didn't give any interpretation of what's going on.
I'm asking for it. You haven't.
We'll come to it. We'll come to it. We'll analyze all the possibilities. Depends on the time, but we'll analyze all the possibilities. This is a complex story. It's not a fast food story. There's a lot of going on here, and we need to. I mean, there are many open questions more than answers. So I don't know.
I'm very surprised at the level in the presence of this inhibitor of histidine is actually then recovering the steady state levels exactly the same as the steady state level. It should be a different steady state level.
I'll tell you why.
No, for that
I have an answer.
Yeah.
Because the 3AT. As I told you, it doesn't have side effects. So it doesn't affect metabolism outside of inhibiting E3. Now, in the normal E3, wild-type E3 regulation, introduction of 3AT affects the system because this doesn't have dynamic range to meet. But here with the GAL system, there is a lot of freedom. You can go.
So
the system is just tuned the level of E3 to overcome this.
Until there's enough
The E3, not the GAL.
It's going to upregulate okay. E3 until there's enough.
Right.
At the same time, it's upregulating E3, it's also upregulating this GAL metabolic pathway.
This is in pure glucose.
It's pure
glucose, the GAL system doesn't have any non-function.
Yeah, it doesn't have a function,
so,
but it is activating that GAL system. Though.
So what?
Yeah.
It doesn't affect
it. Then that has a cost. I mean, it is...
That's an interpretation already. That's an interpretation.
You can ask a question, but say a comment for later.
Okay.
you say that in the wild type, adding this AT would actually lower the metabolic. But you could ask, well, we show here that on a long time scale, everything comes back to the same level. So why in the wild type, if you add AT?
No, wild type transiently. I don't know what happens wild type. But what happens at these levels... It's beyond the capacity of expression of E3 in the wild.
But with wild type on a long time scale,
But cells die. That's experiment we've done. If you take this level of CT, introduce it to wild type, you get dead bodies all over the place. And the reason is very simple, because the maximum level of expression of E3 is much below this. And you block only E3 for long enough, you just kill the cells.
Well, but then raises the question, why wouldn't other feedback loops not raise the challenge?
Well, but it's a different story, it's a different party. We didn't do the experiment in chemostat, so I don't know the answer. Maybe something will happen there. Okay, so I showed you before that if we make a cycle, we go back to galactose and then to glucose, the system memorizes its adapted state. So it's very interesting, this maintenance of adaptation, and we wanted to study it in detail. So the chemostat is in glucose steady state now, and after some time we switch it to galactose steady state. This experiment is with 3AT, doesn't matter, as you see in a moment. And then we collect cells regularly along time. This is in generations now. And we put them on four plates, glucose without and with 3AT, galactose without and with 3AT. And the phenotype is very easy to score, right? If cells are adapted, you get a very fast growth of uniform colonies on glucose plates. If it's not, then it's a previous thing that you saw before, is that it takes a very, very long time to exponential distribution colonies to appear on glucose plates. So this is the phenotype we score for. And what you see on this graph is counting colonies on these four plates after saturation. We let them grow on the plates for long enough, and we count. So you see, at time zero here, generation zero, we switch the chemostat from glucose to galactose. Okay, is that clear? Now the question is, does the memory for adaptation decay with time or not? Okay, this is the question we want to analyze here. What you see here, that the first tens of generations, gal medium is doing worse than anything else. The galactose medium is doing worse. And this is the time it takes for the system to adjust back. We move from glucose to galactose. Now, galactose is bad medium for the system. But wait a second.
What are the different symbols? Is that
the different symbols are the different plates. We put the cells on the same samples of cells, the tight temporal resolution along the experiment. The chemostat is running. Now it's running in galactose, pure galactose. From time zero, from switching from glucose to galactose, after glucose steady state was established, we take a sample of cells from the chemostat, and the same sample of state is put on glucose plates with and without the inhibitor, and on galactose plate without. Then you incubate this plate, come back to them after a few days, and count colonies, okay, and also take pictures of colonies as they develop. And actually you see the kinetics here. This is the kinetics of colony growth on the four plates. Okay, in this figure we normalize all the counts compared to the glucose plate.
That's for a particular length of time?
Yeah, so this is after 40 generation, this is the time point here. You see that the galactose system is fluctuating a lot. It also has worse kinetics here. You see this? It takes for galactose much longer to start growing colonies because we switch the chemostat from glucose to galactose. It takes time for the population now to be adapted both to galactose and glucose. But after the transient is over, this is what you expect from glucose versus galactose metabolism. Glucose grows faster than galactose, so it appears after 2 days. It's over already. And this takes another day or so. But it appears, it gives eventually the same number of colonies. So for hundreds of generations, we did this experiment for 350 generations, there is a precise maintenance of the adaptation state. And in parallel to the chemostat, we propagated the population in serial dilutions by diluting into batch cultures for the same number of generations in media containing histidine, lacking is in different kind of media to try to find is there a medium that will allow resetting this adapted state. Okay, is that clear? It just means that we can the system could maintain its adapted state, and the phenotype is very easy, so it's really big luck, because just looking on the colonies on the plates, we can immediately say if cells are adapted or not. You see, these are uniform size colonies, they appear very fast, and this is not a situation for naive cells that encounter glucose for the first time. Okay, that's. And again, the messenger RNA levels, everything, if you just measure it a long time, it's constant.
The first thing that you showed us was actually that if you transfer from glucose to galactose and wait long enough, and you have the same number. So it is the same as
No, but the time scale is important. You see that glucose, the same number of colonies appears now in galactose and glucose as well. But look, the glucose is much faster than galactose.
But this is what you also showed us in the first slide.
No.
I think the question is, you're choosing some uniform time to pull the plates for the big block. Where is that on the kinetics?
The reference plate?
Yeah. So
the reference plate is dead. So is this, the glucose. Pure glucose.
You take everything out and you plate it, right? And then you wait a set period of time and measure the number of colonies.
For this graph, we wait long enough that no new colonies appear on the plates. So this is the saturated number of colonies appearing on a plate. This shows you the kinetics. This is the number of colonies as a function of time on the different plates.
So the question is the time you're looking much less than the adaptation time for the plates?
No, much less. No, okay. It took 14 days on glucose plate to show something like 10% of the colonies appearing on galactose plates. While here, glucose is the first one to shoot up to maximum level. So the phenotype is very clear. You cannot miss it.
You start with something that's adapted to glucose. It's normal that it can go
well. Yeah, question is the maintenance of the adaptation.
And then you
switch to galactose, it could be that the adapted state decays slowly, and after some time the cells accommodate to galactose and forgot the exercise on glucose, and they need to start all over again. If they need to start all over again, what you expect is to see shift in this glucose kinetics to the right, and also this instead of getting uniform size colonies, you start to see exponential distribution in their size, which is not the case. Okay, so after hundreds of generations, propagation in pure galactose, the system is still adapted to glucose. So the adapted state is not lost easily in different media. We couldn't find any medium that will allow us to reset the phenomena. Okay? So at this point, the geneticists jump and say, it's mutation, it must be mutation. But I can have another few minutes, because I'll show you that life is not so easy. And the question will come at the end, if it's genetic or not, it's interesting. Okay, so in yeast there is a nice trick. In fact, there is more than one cell type in yeast. There are three of them. So the cells we work with is an haploid. It's called A-type. There's also alpha type, and what happens is that if you mix these two together, you get a diploid, A alpha. So there are three types of cells. Okay, so now the exercise is very simple. We take a cell, haploid cell, that is fully adapted to glucose, meaning that the phenotype is that if you put it on a glucose plate, for example, you get uniform size colonies. After 2 days, everything is done. And another haploid cell of the opposite type, that is naive, he never saw glucose in his life. We mix them together and we get diploids. And the question is, what would so these naive cells, this is what you see. After 14 days, you see exponential distribution of colonies. Question is, what will be the diploid? That's a fair question, and then we will undergo meiosis and we'll see what happened. Okay, so this is the exercise.
These all have history.
Yeah. And the medium, again, lacking histidine. So this is the situation. You take a sample of cells after mating, you know that there are diploids, we select for them. You grow a colony in galactose, we propagate everything in galactose, and then we play them on galactose plate and glucose plate, as before. And what you see is an intermediate situation. Nothing that looks like the adapted state, and nothing that looks like the naive state. After five days, you see a lot of colonies. Some of them are already very big. Remember, over there we had to wait 14 days just to get an exponential distribution. You see in the background many, many colonies that are already mature here after 5 days. So here is an intermediate result. It also introduced a lot of variability into the system. So this is certainly not adapted state and certainly not non-adapted state. It's something intermediate. Okay? This is a control experiment. If you take two naive cells and you mate them, the diploid behaves exactly as the haploid. You need to wait many, many days to start to see the first colonies, and you get exponential distribution the same as the haploid. Okay, after 5 days you see nothing. And this is after 5 days. So again, you take a cell that was adapted and naive cell, you mate them, this is the result after 5 days. You take two naive cells and you mate them, and this is the result. You get nothing after 5 days, you start to see colonies after more days. So cells can adapt on glucose plates always, but the question is if they maintain the adapted state. So somehow the phenomena was somewhat diluted, but it was not completely reset here.
Is there another control where you mate to adapted
state? If we mate to adapted state, we didn't do it. It's a good point. We didn't do it. But maybe if you see the next experiment, maybe it's not necessary. We can discuss it. So then the next trick in yeast is that the diploid itself can undergo sporulation. If you starve it and you work in a condition that it's not ferment, it undergoes sporulation. And the trick is, so it undergoes meiosis. And in this meiosis, the diploid will produce four cells, four haploids. And the reason it's a very powerful technique is that they're all contained in the same sac. So now if you separate them, you know exactly the four cells that came through meiosis from the single diploid. So that's what we do. We take these spores and we separate them. So we have now four cells, all came from the diploid cells.
But there is no recombination?
There is a lot of recombination. There is a lot of, the genome is completely mixed now of the two things. And that's and now you analyze the phenotype again. You put it on plates, and that's what you see. Two of the cells in the spore give you full-blown adaptation. Okay? So colonies appear after 2 days, uniform size. So this looks like Mendelian, and two shows nothing. So it looks like a pure Mendelian, 2 to 0, right? You all mix something. I need to explain this. Okay, so where is the chalk? Okay, so it's not only recombination, right? It's a complete mixture of, there are 16 chromosomes in yeast, and none of these cells contain the full set from mother or father. It's that's what sex is doing, right? So there is complete mixture of chromosomes, plus a lot of recombination rate in yeast is enormous. So there is it's complete mixture. Now you say, it's very, very easy for geneticists to see this because this is 2 to 0, it's pure Mendelian. And it means immediately that something occurred in a single locus. Exactly because it's all mixed, it cannot occur, it's not a multi-locus thing, multi-loci thing, but life is not so simple. Because...
Is it the locus that you put it?
No.
No, wait a second. It is a monogenic trait, but is it that control 1 and 4 inherited...
You don't know. It's all mixed. It's a blender. You take it to put it in the blender, you get the salad out, and you don't ask where the cucumber came from. You cannot. Well, there is a way to do it by genotyping. We can talk about it later. But at this stage, you don't know. I don't know.
No, of course you don't know.
There is no meaning to this question because the whole thing is completely mixed.
Where is the one and the
ten? No, wait. You see zero, yeah. 2 to 0. For geneticists, said close. It's not so simple because the zero is not really zero. What is really fantastic is that if you wait a little bit, you see that the two other spores give you exactly what the diploid gave, the intermediate results. So it's not 2 to 0, it's 2 to 2 prime. 2 and 2 prime. The 2 prime is exactly the same phenotype as the diploid. So it's a diluted adapted state, but it's not something that is not adapted. Yeah, the 14 days, but you see already this. In fact, there is a lot of variability. This is another case. You see already after 2.5 days, big colonies appearing. These are the two spores that show nothing at the beginning. These always two are very strong, immediately give you full-blown adaptation. But the other two are very variable. You see already in this one, you see a lot of colonies. Some of them are really very big. So we can discuss this. So I told you it raises more questions than answers. But it means the following. Just from the naive geneticist point of view, this is very simple because this is Mendelian. So there is a single locus mutation or epigenetic. You cannot know at this stage if it could be a strong epigenetic, but it's a single locus. Must be in a single locus. That's a good question. There's no DNA methylation in this. We can discuss it. There are a few possibilities. I think about histone chromatin remodeling, but it's a speculation. We don't know.
What's the generation time for the yeast when it's fully adapted on the speckled plate?
I don't know the generation time, but after 2 days on glucose plate, it's done. It's in saturation. So the generation time is around an hour and a half. 2 hours.
So wait a second, to come back to this single locus state. So what you did here is you take phosphorus from the yeast spore.
Here is the full exercise. You take haploid adapted, okay, with another haploid non-adapted. You get now diploids. So it's intermediate adaptation. Then you starve this guy, and you get 4 haploids. So it undergoes meiosis, and you get 4 haploids that are now questioned if they're adapted or not. Now, these guys completely mix. All the 16 chromosomes are completely mixed, and there is a lot of recombination. So it's all a mixture. So each of these is a mixture of these two.
Then you see the locus, for example, your yeast locus.
So 2 to 0 must be a single locus, because if it's on 2 loci that are not heavily linked, then...
There is a single loci in which there is a single certain difference, which is what we also have in our previous.
No, this is nothing, because I showed you that all the Gal genes, by the way, all reside on different chromosomes.
Some of them have been exposed to glucose before, and some of them...
The naive is also the histidine locus of the Gal, etc., as the other one. It's not the...
No, it doesn't have, but it doesn't matter. Because it's on plasmid, it doesn't matter. It's on plasmid. In the diploid, you get a mixture. You get a mixture of everything. No, after the mating.
No, before the mating.
Before the mating, the genes are identical, exactly identical.
They are identical.
Identical, yeah, it's exactly the same genome.
The adapted.
No, let me try to clarify. Understand what to worry.
The adapted, you have a chromosome for the each chromosome of the adapted, in which you have inserted histidine other chromosomes.
No, this is on plasmid. It's on plasmid. No, but wait a second. But the phenomena is not is the phenomena. It does not show up on a single locus. It's many genes adapt. All the Gal genes, for example, reside on different chromosomes, and they all adapt.
But here what he says is that there's a single locus.
No, I'll finish in a few minutes. Okay, let me finish, and then we can discuss it. Actually, you can finish if you want. So let me summarize, and then. Okay, let me summarize. what I've tried to show you, that there is a long-term adaptation of gene regulation. You have to remember it's induced by the environment, so only switching to glucose caused this phenomenon. We ran the chemostat for hundreds of generations in galactose, and cells are never adapted. You always do the same learning curve. And there is unknown mechanism. This cell state is fixated in the population by unknown mechanism. And in fact, I made here a list. So I don't know if adaptation is genetic or non-genetic. I don't know that. And there are, in fact, four possibilities to explain what we see. It could be a genetic mutation followed by selection. It could be epigenetic inheritance, chromatin modification, or any factors. We can discuss this. It could be a mixture of genetics plus epigenetic, and could be a Lamarckian process where the cells inherited useful modification induced by the environment. But recall some facts, and by recalling these facts, we can eliminate a lot of this speculation. First of all, on plates, all colonies could grow. So all cells, the same number of cells eventually appear on galactose plate, on glucose plate as on galactose plates. It means all cells could adapt. It's not a rare phenomenon. Usually, when spontaneous mutation occurs, you have to select for it. It's a rare phenomenon outside of many cells, so there is no selection of a rare subpopulation. If you want another 2 minutes, I'll show you a model that shows that the system also couldn't have a priori variability into it that allows just selection on it. This is impossible. In fact, I need to explain this because this is an important thing. The chemostat dynamics shows two time scales, right? There is a decay, an exponential decay. There is an adaptation time scale, adaptation time, and then growth. Okay? I switch to glucose here. So this time scale and this exponential increase determine two important time scales in the population dynamics. Okay? Now, this time scale reflects how better fitted are the adapted cells compared to the background population. That's the reason you get an exponential increase here. So if I would have, suppose I have a population here with some of the cells have the capability to adapt at the onset. Okay, the time scale is too short to start the whole machinery probably of mutation and everything, but it could be that there are some cells, there is a lot of variability in the system, so there could be some cells that are adapted at the onset, and then the system just selects them.
Well, does that first curve match the diffusion?
Diffusion of what?
You mean basically your dilution
rate? No, that's what I said. The dilution goes like that. Now, in a model, so we compute a two-population model, taking this exponent as input of the different fitness of the two populations, and then you can easily see that it's not compatible with the long time scales you get from here, because if you have a subpopulation that is already adapted here, you cannot match both this time scale and the first exponential growth. I can show you the results of the model. If you have time. No, not in the chemostat. East don't do that anyway, but in the chemostat it's also impossible. Transfer. So, we call it in the chemostat adaptation is fast, it's around 10 generations. It's really very fast time scale. The people have done experiments on. In chemostat on East, and beneficial mutations take something like hundreds of generations to be fixated in the population. This is much shorter than this. It occurs only after a medium switch, and the dynamic trajectory is completely predictable. So if you repeat the experiment, I can exactly predict what will happen. So this, again, works against spontaneous mutation. Mating shows that adaptation is a quantitative phenomenon in nature. It's not all or none. It's not adaptive or non-adaptive. It's a quantitative phenomenon. It can be weakened or strengthened by the situation. And following meiosis, two cells exhibit strong adaptation, two intermediate, levels of adaptation similar to the deep fluid. Okay? So, I think what really fascinates me is that gene recruitment, which is in some way complementary to gene deletion, is a technology that allows us to really explore the capacity of cells to adapt and to see the potential of them. And for example, what we do now, we do the same trick of gene recruitment to other regulatory system. What we do, we tie E3 to the cell cycle, to different parts of the cell cycle, and see how the system can adapt to that. And what the experiment shows is that it can develop new feedback loops to take care of the new inputs.
Do you suspect a transposon system at all?
Yeah, it is. But again, so this just means that genetic changes can be accelerated by much, but nevertheless, even on for transposon, this is very limiting. 10 generation is really very limiting.
Have they found transposon families?
Yeah, there is in this. Let me just finish by this graph, and maybe I'll just show the bottom results. So this just a check, but it's a nice check that the system is still under the Gall system. So the hallmark of the Gall system is sensitivity to the carbon source, galactose glucose. And here is an experiment where we run in a chemostat, we just increase the level of the competitive inhibitor. So we go from 40 millimolar to 80. It's enormous level. This is in pure glucose, you see nothing, very little happens. The metabolism is not affected by much, because the system has a lot of dynamic range to go. But then you switch to galactose at the same level of CT, the system collapses. And the reason it collapses is because the expression of E3 that is required here now takes resources from the galactose utilization. The system cannot accommodate the condition in the chemostat. You switch back to glucose, you get boom, the same steady state immediately.
I didn't understand. I thought that in the condition of 80 millimolar CT, you're really overexpressing the galactose system, so even the
lactose
should be easy.
No, 40. Okay, so this is the you drag me into a different. I didn't want to talk about it, but this is the experiment in pure galactose. This is 50 millimolar CT. This is 30 millimolar. See what happened. In 50 millimolar, it's already too much for the cell. So we switch at zero. We introduce the CT. There is a steady state in galactose here, with no CT. Then there is a decay. There is some adaptation and it goes to a different level, which is already lower than the previous one. If you go to 30 millimolar, it undergoes the same dynamics. Go down, but then boom, it goes to a higher level of metabolism. And the reason it can go here to a higher level of metabolism than the original one is that 30 millimolar inhibitor does good for the cells because it's overexpressed in galactose, and the 30 millimolar allows it to better tune E3 to the right working point. So in glucose, on the other end, because the Gall system doesn't have essential function, then the system can work out the full dynamic range of the Gall system, and it can go to very high levels of inhibitor without any effect. Okay, I think I should stop here and the model, if you want, we can talk about it later.
Very puzzled by